Chapter 7. The Burden of Killing. Quote, Alfred de Vigny went to the heart of the military experience when he observed that the soldier is both victim and executioner. Not only does he run the risk of being killed and wounded himself, but he also kills and wounds others. John Keegan and Richard Holmes, Soldiers. The resistance to the close-range killing of one's own species is so great that it is often sufficient to overcome the cumulative influences of the instinct for self-protection, the coercive forces of leadership, the expectancy of peers, and the obligation to preserve the lives of comrades. The soldier in combat is trapped within this tragic catch-22. If he overcomes his resistance to killing and kills an enemy soldier in close combat, he will be forever burdened with blood guilt. And if he elects not to kill, then the blood guilt of his fallen comrades and the shame of his profession, nation, and cause lie upon him. He is damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. To kill and the guilt thereof. William Manchester, author and U.S. Marine veteran of World War II, felt remorse and shame after his close-range personal killing of a Japanese soldier. I can remember, he wrote, whispering foolishly, I'm sorry, and then just throwing up. I threw up all over myself. It was a betrayal of what I'd been taught since a child. Other combat veterans tell of the emotional responses associated with a close-range kill that echo Manchester's horror. The media's depiction of violence tries to tell us that men can easily throw off the moral inhibitions of a lifetime, and whatever other instinctive restraint exists, and kill casually and guiltlessly in combat. The men who have killed, and who will talk about it, tell a different tale. A few of these quotes, which are drawn from Keegan and Holmes, can be found elsewhere in this study, but here they represent the distilled essence of the soldier's emotional response to killing. Killing is the worst thing that one man can do to another man. It's the last thing that should happen anywhere. Israeli lieutenant. I reproached myself like a destroyer. An inescapable uneasiness came over me. I felt almost like a criminal. Napoleonic-era British soldier. This was the first time I had killed anybody. And when things quieted down, I went over and looked at a German I knew I had shot. I remembered thinking that he looked old enough to have a family, and I felt very sorry. British World War I veteran, after his first kill. It didn't hit me all that much then. But when I think of it now, I slaughtered those people. I murdered them. German World War II veteran. And I froze, because it was a boy. I would say between the ages of 12 and 14. When he turned at me and looked, all of a sudden he turned his whole body and pointed his automatic weapon at me. I just opened up, fired the whole 20 rounds right at the kid, and he just laid there. I dropped my weapon and cried. U.S. Special Forces officer and Vietnam veteran. I fired again and somehow got him in the head. There was so much blood, I vomited, until the rest of the boys came up. Israeli Six-Day War veteran. So this new Peugeot comes towards us, and we shoot. And there was a family there, three children, and I cried. But I couldn't take the chance. Children, father, mother, all the family was killed. But we couldn't take the chance. Israeli-Lebanon incursion veteran. The magnitude of the trauma associated with killing became particularly apparent to me in an interview with Paul, a VFW post commander and a sergeant in the 101st Airborne at Bastogne in World War II. He talked freely about his experiences and about comrades who had been killed. But when I asked him about his own kills, he stated that usually you couldn't be sure who it was that did the killing. Then tears welled up in Paul's eyes. And after a long pause, he said, but the one time I was sure. And then his sentence was stopped by a little sob, and pain racked the face of this old gentleman. It still hurts after all these years, I asked, in wonder. Yes, he said, after all these years. And he would not speak of it again. The next day he told me, you know, the questions you're asking, you must be very careful not to hurt anyone with these questions. Not me, you know. I can take it. But some of these young guys are still hurting very badly. These guys don't need to be hurt anymore. These memories were the scabs of terrible hidden wounds in the minds of these kind and gentle men. Not to kill and the guilt thereof. With very few exceptions, everyone associated with killing in combat reaps a bitter harvest of guilt. The soldier's guilt. Numerous studies have concluded that men in combat are usually motivated to fight not by ideology or hate or fear, but by group pressures and processes involving 1. Regard for their comrades, 2. Respect for their leaders, 3. Concern for their own reputation with both, and 4. An urge to contribute to the success of the group. Repeatedly, we see combat veterans describe the powerful bonds that men forge in combat as stronger than those of husband and wife. John Early, a Vietnam veteran and an ex-Rhodesian mercenary, described it to Dyer this way. This is going to sound really strange, but there's a love relationship that is nurtured in combat because the man next to you, you're depending on him for the most important thing you have, your life. And if he lets you down, you're either maimed or killed. If you make a mistake, the same thing happens to him. So the bond of trust has to be extremely close. And I'd say this bond is stronger than almost anything, with the exception of parent and child. It's a hell of a lot stronger than man and wife. Your life is in his hands. You trust that person with the most valuable thing you have. This bonding is so intense that it is fear of failing these comrades that preoccupies many combatants. Countless sociological and psychological studies, the personal narratives of numerous veterans, and the interviews I have conducted clearly indicate the strength of the soldier's concern for failing his buddies. The guilt and trauma associated with failing to fully support men who are bonded with friendship and camaraderie on this magnitude is profoundly intense. Yet every soldier and every leader feels this guilt to one degree or another. For those who know that they have not fired, while their friends died around them, the guilt is dramatic. And the leader's guilt. The responsibilities of a combat leader represent a remarkable paradox. To be truly good at what he does, he must love his men and be bonded to them with powerful links of mutual responsibility and affection. And then he must ultimately be willing to give the orders that may kill them. To a significant degree, the social barrier between officer and enlisted men and between sergeant and private exists to enable the superior to send his men into mortal danger and to shield him from the inevitable guilt associated with their deaths. For even the best leaders make some mistakes that will weigh forever upon their consciences. Just as any good coach can analyze his conduct of even a winning game and see where he could have done better, so does every good combat leader think at some level that if he had just done something different, these men he loved like sons and brothers, might not have died. It is extraordinarily difficult to get these leaders to reminisce along these lines. Quote, "Now tactically, I had done everything the way it was supposed to be done, but we lost some soldiers. There was no other way. We could not go around that field. We had to go across it. Did I make a mistake? I don't know. Would I have done it differently another time? I don't think I would have, because that's the way I was trained. Did we lose less soldiers by my doing it this way? That's a question that'll never be answered." Major Robert Uhle, Vietnam veteran, quoted in Gwen Dyer, War. This is a deadly dangerous line of thought for leaders, and the honors and decorations that are traditionally heaped upon military leaders at all levels are vitally important for their mental health in the years that follow. These decorations, medals, mentions in dispatches, and other forms of recognition represent a powerful affirmation from the leader's society, telling him that he did well, he did the right thing, and no one blames him for the lives lost in doing his duty. Denial and the burden of killing. Balancing the obligation to kill with the resulting toll of guilt forms a significant cause of psychiatric casualties on the battlefield. Philosopher-psychologist Peter Mann speaks of the soldier's lesson in responsibility and guilt. What the soldier knows as a result of war is that the dead remain dead, the maimed are forever maimed, and there is no way to deny one's responsibility or culpability, for those mistakes are written forever and as if in fire in others' flesh. Ultimately, there may be no way to deny one's responsibility or culpability for mistakes written forever and as if in fire in others' flesh. But combat is a great furnace fed by the small flickering flames of attempts at denial. The burden of killing is so great that most men try not to admit that they have killed. They deny it to others, and they try to deny it to themselves. Denter quotes a hardened veteran who, upon being asked about killing, stated emphatically that most of the killing you do in modern war is impersonal. A thing few people realize is that you hardly ever see a German. Very few men, even in the infantry, actually have the experience of aiming a weapon at a German and seeing the man fall. Even the language of men at war is full of denial of the enormity of what they have done. Most soldiers do not kill. Instead, the enemy was knocked over, wasted, greased, taken out, and mopped up. The enemy is hosed, zapped, probed, and fired on. The enemy's humanity is denied, and he becomes a strange beast called a kraut, jap, reb, yank, dink, slant, slope, or raghead. Even the weapons of war receive benign names. Puff the Magic Dragon, Walleye, Toe, Fat Boy, and Thin Man. And the killing weapon of the individual soldier becomes a piece or a hog, and a bullet becomes a round. Our enemies do the same thing. Matt Brennan tells of Khan, a Vietnam scout assigned to his platoon. This individual had been a loyal Viet Cong until a North Vietnamese squad made a mistake and killed his wife and children. Now he loved to run ahead of the Americans, hunting for North Vietnamese soldiers. He called the communists gooks, just as we did, and one night I asked him why. "Khan, do you think it's right to call the VC gooks and dinks?" He shrugged. "It makes no difference to me. Everything has a name. Do you think the Americans are the only ones who do that? My company in the jungle called you big hairy monkeys. We kill monkeys and," he hesitated for an instant, "we eat them." The dead soldier takes his misery with him, but the man who killed him must forever live and die with him. The lesson becomes increasingly clear. Killing is what war is all about, and killing in combat, by its very nature, causes deep wounds of pain and guilt. The language of war helps us to deny what war is really about, and in doing so, it makes war more palatable.